Good morning.
Good morning.
Whew. So I've just been asked to introduce myself. I am Hunter Roberts. Actually, formally, since Bob is F. Bob, I'm W. Hunter Roberts, no relation to the other W. I am a student at Swedenborgian House of Studies. And just so you know, having completed my MDiv 15 years ago at Starr King School for the Ministry, also on the Graduate Theological Union campus, how I wended my way back to campus is a long tale of exile and return. And when I got back to campus, I met with the inimitable Carla Frederick in a class, and she says she discovered me and brought me to this wonderful church where I am now slated, if all goes as planned in our world, if God's in agreement with that, I will be ordained next summer in 2006, and hopefully serving a church beginning around this time next year. Woo! And I'm really happy about that. So thank you again for welcoming me into your world. I feel a little daunted on the eve or morning, I guess it is, of my first lecture here at Freiburg. I said to somebody yesterday, there's an expression that some of you may have read many years ago, Stranger in a Strange Land. Remember that book? About Michael Valentine Smith, who came from Mars and tried to make sense of these strange humans. I feel a little bit like one of his expressions was, I am but an egg, which is an expression that's always stayed with me. And this morning I feel a bit like an egg talking to the chickens, telling them about the great chicken. I am but an egg, so I hope you'll be forgiving. If the egg doesn't really fully understand chickenness altogether yet. And to compound it, you know, as I began to work on this question, and as soon as Ken asked me or Jim asked me, well, what are you going to talk about? I thought, oh, goodness, I have to figure that out. They're not just going to tell me. Okay. I thought, well, you know, really, to me, if we take the great commandments seriously, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy mind, and to love thy neighbor as thyself, if we take that seriously, then perhaps the most interesting question, maybe even the most important question that I can think of to ask, vis-a-vis the New Testament or the Greek scriptures, is, well, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, which pretty much all Christians can agree on, and we can agree on that, the question is, who is my neighbor? You know, as they say, the devil's in the details. And in this case, the Lord is in the details, I expect. So as I began to grapple with this question, and particularly last night, sitting with George Dole, it got more and more difficult to figure out. So I kind of may leave you with more questions than answers today, and I hope that's okay with you. I don't think I have a particularly clear answer to that question. And yet the way we answer that question makes all the difference in the world. It's just absolutely huge. The way we answer, who is my neighbor, it seems to me, affects, let's start with our church priorities, you know, as churches. If our neighbor is predominantly those members of our congregation, then that means our church's job predominantly is to serve as ministers and as congregants, other members of our congregation. Nothing wrong with that. But if our neighbor is the homeless person. And I'm going to keep coming back to the homeless person because I live in Northern California and we have a lot of them. You don't have so many here in Maine, I don't expect, because it gets too cold. They come to California. Huh?
They're there.
They're there? Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Then you know. If it's the homeless person, if that's our neighbor as much as our congregants or our fellow congregants, that affects even our financial decisions as a church. That affects whether we and how we extend out into the community and whether we do a soup kitchen or, you know, remodel the bathroom, perhaps. You know, there are all kinds of just really nuts and bolts, nitty-gritty decisions that get made based on our underlying presuppositional structures about who our neighbor is. And I'm gonna say something here about presuppositional structures because it's something that I probably need to define since I use that notion a lot. We all have suppositions. And our suppositions are those suppositions that we can pretty much articulate and define. If somebody would ask you a question, you would probably answer, I suppose so, or I suppose not, if it was about one of your suppositions. If I were sitting at a bus stop, and I knew the bus route, and somebody says, does this bus take me to campus? And it was the bus that was taking one to campus, and that was what it was for. I would say, yes, I suppose so. Yes, this bus takes you to campus. The underlying presupposition there is, do the buses run? Does the schedule actually reflect reality? Now, if I'm in Berkeley, the answer is probably so. But I found out, you know, 20 years ago that if I was in Greece, it was an even bet. You know? So your presuppositions are those suppositions underneath your suppositions about how reality works. And I think that in many cases, there are presuppositions impacting those kinds of choices that have to do with, I'm going to assert that many of us have presuppositions about who our neighbor is, that we may not have actually thought about it all that much, but we operate, or we may have thought about it, but we're still more or less operating out of our presuppositions. So just sort of have that in mind, and I may return to it. Okay, so it's going to affect our church priorities. It's also going to affect our personal living, how we identify our neighbor. It's going to affect our interaction with people on a very daily basis. Those people who we consider sort of outside our ken, outside that which we see as related to us, and I'm going to come back to that too. The telemarketer who interrupts your dinner, is that your neighbor? Exactly, you know? Or the person, for me, it's the person on the other end of the helpline when my computer has crashed and I have already tried 3 times what they're suggesting. It's very hard in those moments for me to remember that person is my neighbor. But it also gets into some fairly dicey problems. You know, if we are to take, and I'm going to read that piece of scripture again in a minute. If we're going to take Jesus's injunction seriously, when someone strikes your cheek, offer them the other. How do we deal with that in cases of spousal abuse? Because that injunction has, in fact, been used to justify spousal abuse in some cases. Not so much currently, maybe, but not so long ago. I think it gets complicated. I think it also impacts our social and economic policy. Let me give some examples from the past as well as from the present. Slavery. There were a great many people, only a couple of 150 years ago, who were very pious people, who were Christian people, who thought they were practicing the Great Commandment, who owned slaves, who worked slaves, who bought and sold slaves, who even had involuntary sex with slaves. Consider our own Thomas Jefferson. So, who our neighbor is has huge implications for all kinds of things. Social policy, programs for the poor, education, foreign aid, war. So, having said that, I'm going to attempt here, just having sort of raised why I think it's a question worth dealing with. What I'm going to attempt to do in the next few minutes is look at what Jesus said. I'm going to talk about that in a second. I'm going to relook at that scripture and talk about what would taking that seriously mean? What would that portend? What would that call us to do? And I'm going to try to, in some way, integrate that with Swedenborg's doctrine of degrees of neighbor. And in putting those together, I'm going to see if that helps us to figure out how to figure out who our neighbor is and at what level. All right? So let's start with this Jesus injunction. Because it's troubling. It's troubling. I'm going to say something here about a group called the Jesus Seminar. Are any of you familiar with the Jesus Seminar? A little bit. Okay. Well, so you may know there are all kinds of scholars who are very diligent and rigorous and committed people. Most of them are Christians who have devoted a great deal of their lives to figuring out what in Scripture really comes from back then, because we're 2,000 years in the past, and the few, you know, ahead of, that's 2,000 years behind us, that's what I'm trying to say. So knowing exactly, I mean, there's some stuff we're pretty sure of. We're pretty sure that Jesus lived. We're pretty sure that he was an incredible teacher who taught in parables, and that he had a profound impact on people. We're pretty sure something miraculous happened. I'm talking from a scholarly point of view here. But what he actually said, when you start comparing scriptures and doing the analysis of what they call form criticism and historical criticism, there are ways that they have of kind of dissecting what expressions would have actually been there at that time, for example, in form criticism. So if something translated back to dude, don't something, 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 we would know that was probably inserted more recently. By that same means, these scholars analyze, compare documents, try to figure out what came from what, because we know that none of the disciples were literate and none of them wrote anything down. That we were pretty sure of. So everything was written at least 30 years after the crucifixion. So how do they figure out, what did he say? Well, so these scholars, without going into a great deal of detail, these scholars put their heads together, and they, a great many of them, met over the course of a number of years and tried to analyze what can we be really sure of that Jesus said? What can we be moderately sure of that he probably said? What kind of sounds like something in the direction of what he might have said, and what is almost certainly an add-on from somebody who had an axe to grind? And that came out with the Jesus Seminar, the Five Gospels. Well, anyway, so I say all that as a way of prefacing the things that they put in red in this book, they can be pretty sure he said. That's what they're saying. Now, I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying that they've got a probably better educated guess than I do. Because what do I know? The things, among the very few things that they put in red in the Gospel of Luke, were the injunctions that I read to you this morning and the story of the Good Samaritan. But the story of the Good Samaritan, so they said in red, we've got, hold on, love your enemies. When someone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other as well. When someone takes away your coat, don't prevent that person from taking your shirt along with it. Give to everyone who begs from you. When someone takes your things, don't ask for them back. That's actually not in red, that's in blue. That was in the, probably something in that direction. So we can pretty much assume he said that, if we're to believe the Jesus Seminar. Then it goes on to use the Good Samaritan, but here's where it ends. So when Jesus was asked, who is my neighbor? Here's what he said. May I read this? Is that okay? Everybody knows this story, right? There's a man going to Jericho. He falls in the hands of robbers. They strip him. Two Judeans come along. They don't notice him or they don't help him. And then a Samaritan, who everybody thought was sort of the lowest of the low, helps him. And he puts him on a donkey. He says, look after. And here's how it ends. The next day he took out 2 silver coins, which he gave to the innkeeper, and said, look after him, and on my way back I'll reimburse you for any expense you have had, any extra expense you have had. Now, the last phrase, they say, of that, the sort of tying it up, which we read in most versions of Luke, they say, no, Jesus didn't say that. He left it to us to figure it out, which is very typical of his teachings. He seems to consistently have done that. He left it to us to figure it out. So how do we figure it out, and how do we take that seriously? If we look at the Good Samaritan parable, we see that the trouble was the first people to pass, the Judeans, who one would have expected to stop for a fellow Judean, they didn't see the man in the ditch. He was beyond their seeing because he was outside of what they considered themselves related to. So then, in order to discern who is our neighbor, perhaps the question we need to ask is, to whom are we related? To whom are we related? George talked yesterday about perception. What we see and what we filter out. I can't remember the number of impulses. If any of you have seen a movie called What the Bleep Do We Know? Are you familiar with that in this part of the country? It's about perception and how we filter out and what we, right? We get so many impressions in a second that we filter some out, and we take in a very select number. So in a sense, perception is everything. So to consider someone as a neighbor, first of all, we have to be able to see them. And secondly, we have to be able to see the good in them. That is to say, we have to see them as having something of value. We have to consider them at least related to something we value. So then we ask ourselves, do we see the homeless person on the street? I mean, I see so many people walk by, homeless people, and I sometimes do it myself. Do I not see them? Do I not want to see them? Do I not consider myself related to them? So it seems to me that where we cut off our relatedness, if neighbor is based on relatedness, where we cut off our relatedness is simply by not seeing the good in the other. How do we relate to the homeless person in the street? Now, here's where I went with that. How we find our relatedness to the other is by finding the good in them. And Swedenborg tells us that there is good in everybody because everyone's life is ultimately God's life flowing into them. Everyone, therefore, would have to have good in them. The good in them has the same source as the good in you. So then we have to say, well, then I'm related to everyone. The answer to who am I related to is everyone. Yikes. So with that in mind, it seems to me then the question is, what are our responsibilities to our neighbors? This is where I turn to Swedenborg, because Jesus didn't tell us, really. Swedenborg does something very interesting. He says, hold on, Swedenborg 52. This is what the simple do. This is from the little book Charity that I got from Lee a couple days ago. This is what the simple do. They say, every man is equally my neighbor. Also, they say, it is not my business to investigate his quality. This is regarded by God. I must simply help my neighbor. Yet this is not loving the neighbor. He who loves a neighbor from genuine charity finds out what sort of a man he is and does good to him or her with discrimination in accordance with the quality of his or her good. So Swedenborg's telling us that there is a practice of discernment. So I want to distinguish between judgment and discernment. Because judgment is only God's. But that doesn't mean that we can't discern. In fact, that's what we're given reason for, I believe, is to practice discernment. Ken Wilber, I don't know if any of you are familiar, so I'm sure some of you are familiar with Ken Wilber. He's a Buddhist philosopher and scholar who has put together more different macro systems of thought than one would have thought possible. He's encyclopedic. And he's very critical of this New Age idea of equating judgment with discernment. And he says, you know, this is why good people, well-intentioned people, have their foot nailed to the floor. because they're unwilling to practice discernment. They're unwilling to say, this is right and this is wrong based on this. And here's the moral authority by which I say so. And I don't judge you. Wilbert says, you know, we completely keep our feet nailed to the floor, and we give those who are willing to make those statements out of arrogance and pride they can take the day, because we're sitting here saying, well, who am I to judge? So Swedenborg says, no, you have to practice discernment. You know, just because you're not judging someone doesn't mean that if they're, you know, if they ask you for a knife and they're going to kill you, you hand them the knife. That's not what turn the other cheek means. So now, if I look at my dilemma, so every time I walk by a homeless person in Berkeley, and it happens all the time. When it first started happening a lot, back when I was in seminary the first time around, I just walked around with a pocket of quarters. I decided this is the simple answer. I'm going to walk around with a pocket of quarters, and I'm not going to determine if this person is going to use it well. I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to hand them a quarter. If they ask, that's good enough for me. I don't do that anymore. And I asked myself why as I was working on this, you know. I said, well, now, you know, is it because I'm jaded? That was 15 years ago. I've seen 15 years worth of homeless people since then. I don't know. George pointed out last night that perhaps I'm less concerned with appearances and how I look to myself than I did 15 years ago. But I know that, is it that I don't see them anymore? You know, I don't know. I hadn't really grappled with it until working on this talk. But I do know that now I really stop and think about when I see someone who is an obvious alcoholic. I think, you know, I'm not sure I want to be codependent to that. So again, more questions than answers. Now I'm going to jump to a different place and ask a different question, and hopefully we'll tie them back together. Having asked the question of how to evaluate what my responsibilities are at different levels to different neighbors. Finding the good, I'm sorry, I just lost myself here. What are my responsibilities to my neighbor? Then I'm going to ask, are my responsibilities to my neighbors equal at different levels? Now that's also a very interesting question. There's a moral development psychologist that wrote primarily, she's still writing, but her most famous work was, I believe, in the mid to late 1980s by the name of Carol Gilligan. She was at Harvard, and she asked a very interesting question about moral theory and the theory of how people develop morally. Up until then, it had always been assumed that male moral development was human moral development, and that the stages that boys go through in moral development are the stages that everybody should go through in moral development. Well, Gilligan said, hold on a minute, I just want to check this out. And so she started asking girls the same questions, and I won't go into that. If anybody wants to talk to me about it, I'll tell you about it. But the point is that what she discovered is that women, and there was obviously some crossover. Some men do it this way and some women do it that way. But by and large, what she found, for whatever reasons, is that women have relational morality. Instead of saying, what principle do I apply to this moral dilemma? Women are more likely to say, how is my answer to this moral dilemma going to affect my relationships? And depending on the woman's moral development and the level it's at, then the question is, What does she consider herself related to? Does she only consider herself related to herself or her immediate family? You know, like the case of the woman who killed the competition for her daughter for cheerleader that we heard about 10 years or so ago. She was operating out of a relational morality. And the only one she was related to was her daughter. So there, dangerous stuff. Or do we consider ourselves related to our community? Or do we consider ourselves related to our society, our nation, our planet, our cosmos? Whoops, I'm sorry. I'm getting the butterfly related there. Swedenborg, in his extraordinary wisdom, way ahead of anybody else, presaged Gilligan by saying, and I've changed the language here to make it inclusive. He says, but the neighbor is not only human singly, but also human collectively, as a less or greater society, our country, the church, the Lord's kingdom, and above all, the Lord himself. These are the neighbor to whom good is to be done from love. These are also ascending degrees of neighbor, for a society of many is neighbor in a higher degree than a single human is. Whoa, I'm going to read that again. For a society of many is neighbor in a higher degree than a single human is. In a still higher degree is our country. In a still higher degree is the church. In a still higher degree is the Lord's kingdom. But in the highest degree is the Lord. These ascending degrees are like the steps of a ladder at the top of which is the Lord. So as you can see, I have these like nesting boxes, degrees of neighbor. And it's not so much hierarchies of importance as hierarchies of dependence, in that this, the Lord's kingdom, could not exist without the Lord. The planet could not exist without the Lord's kingdom. The country could not exist without the planet. The society could not exist without the country. The community could not exist without the society. Or the church could not exist without the society. And so on until we get down to my intimate personal relations are dependent on those larger, I'm going to use the term that Wilbur uses, holons. A holon is something that is a part but is also a whole. So my I is a holon in my body. It's made up of many holons, which are molecules and atoms and neutrons. Each of those is a holon inside a larger holon. So the holon of my existence as an individual nests inside of all of those holons. And if I don't pay attention to them, as my neighbor. Swedenborg says I'm missing the boat. I have a responsibility at that larger level. Not more than, but more fundamentally than. So our fundamental responsibility then is to the Lord first and to the Lord's kingdom, which is the entire living world, visible and invisible, through which God's life flows. If we're to take both Jesus' injunction seriously, to love our neighbor, really, and Swedenborg's writings and teaching seriously about degrees of neighbor, that's where it leaves us, it seems to me. And I say this has radical implications for a social gospel. It's not enough to just be nice to our immediate neighbors, what we usually think of as our neighbors. If we're related to God's entire kingdom, that means that we have responsibility to people on the other side of the world, to the air and the water, to heaven, and to future generations. The Native Americans taught their children to think in terms of seven generations hence. So it seems to me this calls us to justice, and it calls us to live with an awareness of our relatedness. So then I'll throw one more question at you, and then I'll stop, which is the question of what would it be like to live really with this radical awareness? Swedenborg speaks of being charity. I don't know how I missed that the first time around. But when I read it this time, it absolutely rocked my world. He says it's not enough to do charity. That's just the external, and you talked about that yesterday, Ken. It's not enough either to just feel love and compassion. He tells us that charity is a state of being. It's not an action. And that state of being is a being, a receptacle for God's goodness and charity toward the other, toward the good in the other, which is also God's goodness. So I'm just going to read this thing to you here, charity number 96. By the way, what I read before, that last quote about ascending the degrees of neighbor, was from Heavenly Doctrine number 86, if anybody wants to know. Okay, by a charity in form is meant that the person's life is a charity, and the form is from the person's life. But how this is will be told in what follows in the fourth article. So in other words, he says, we are, if we let God in, if we let God's goodness guide us, it's not just that we're going to be doing charity, which we will, but we will actually be being charity, which is an extraordinary notion, that we are charity in form. So to the extent that we can be charity, our actions would simply fall out of our being. There would be no question. When we're being charity, then we just be it. It's not about thinking about what am I going to do at any level of neighbor. So in that being, we would see each other as sacred. We would see the world as sacred. We would see our own beings as sacred. There's no stopping point in that where we would say, that, or he, or she, is not important, not valuable, not related. All life would be honored by virtue of its relatedness, in whatever degree. So we would arrive at that point in which we would see the world, using the phrase that also a Buddhist scholar, systems theorist, wrote a book called World as Lover, World as Self. And I just think that title really epitomizes in many ways what both Swedenborg and Christ are pointing us toward. So I'm sorry to have been long-winded, but that's what I have to say on who is our neighbor. So questions, comments?
On the matter of discrimination, I recall reading some years ago that a woman who was in charge of services to the homeless in New York City resigned because she decided homelessness was not a workable category.
Mm.
It, And the semester on sabbatical, when I volunteered at a homeless shelter in Boston, one of my overpowering impressions was the variety of people who came through. I recall one woman who was just profoundly embarrassed to be there.
Yeah.
And others who were terribly manipulative.
Yeah.
Some who were mentally deficient, incompetent.
Yeah.
Some who obviously had psychological problems. And they all get lumped into this category.
Yes.
You know, some with alcohol, drug problems. They're different, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
And if you take seriously what Swedenborg says about the spiritual world being the world of causes, you've got to get under the surface. You've got to look under the surface of the manifest homeless, which is a very physical definition, to see what's making it happen, which is in part systemic, but also a very individualistic, takes all kinds of different ways.
Thank you. I mean, I think that that's true of so many categories. And I think that a lot of the time, those categories are actually there for the express evil purpose of having us not see. You know, we can just sort of dismiss, oh, that's a schizophrenic or a homeless or a whatever. Yeah. Yeah, Dean.
I'd like to confess my generation, the generation that came of age at the end of the 60s, we were willfully not ever judging anyone. You could just never say anything.
Yeah.
As we watched people fall into addictions, hatreds, all violence, and, you know, what the heck were we thinking? That we just, our precious choice of not saying anything, of not being discerning, was more sacred than the life of another person. And I feel very guilty about my part in that. But I guess I'm coming to this. You said we have to be charity.
Yeah.
But it's not like this pleasant area where we're just being. We have to use the tools that Swedenborg of our will and our understanding. We have to see the truth and be able to say with love that truth.
Thank you. Yeah. Wilbur wrote a very interesting and I think hysterically funny book. Some people don't like it at all. Actually, most people don't like it at all. But it's called Boomeritis, in which he satirizes that generation for exactly that. Yeah.
Perhaps the role of the church in this reminds me of a parable of Gustav Weigel, was a United Church of Christ theologian, and he told the parable about some people who were concerned about sailors being dashed on the rocks, so they built a lighthouse. Then they got together and people built a house to house these people when they saved them. And the ladies made the curtains and beds and they had everything all ready. And then it got to be too good. What do you want those people in this nice place? And so that's sort of the church, like we get too good to serve real needs.
Thank you. Suzanne.
And because you brought up the issue of homelessness as the example, that's been an area that I've learned a lot in recently, because my new daughter-in-law, Megan, runs a homeless ministry in San Francisco. And the question that you raised about discerning, especially about financial resources and giving, one of the things that she taught me as we were walking along the streets of San Francisco, and of course a lot of the homeless people know her as their pastor, so they greet her. And she doesn't give money, but she acknowledges everyone. And she said, that's something you can always do. You can always give them the honor and respect that they're a human being. And you can say, no, I don't have any money today. I hope you have a great day. And just to talk to people is giving them something they need that they may not have asked for, but you've given them something and discerned that you can, as a person, honor that they are a child of God too.
Hmm. That reminds me of one time when I was walking down the street. And I don't remember, there was a older African-American man sitting there, and I don't remember if I gave him anything or I didn't, but we had a brief conversation, and I said, have a great day. And he said, the Lord didn't make no other kind. And I was like, you know, for him to say that was, still brings tears to my eyes when I remember it. Yeah. What time are we supposed to end? Are we done? Oh, I didn't realize that. I'm so sorry.